Judge Barker's decision that James Harrison was denied his right to an impartial judge is correct and must be affirmed. The facts Judge Barker found have not been today or ever in dispute. The facts show an extrajudicial source that resulted in, to use Judge Barker's language, an unmistakable bias. Several months before she was killed, Stacy Forsey, the victim in this case, provided information to the Indiana State Police. She provided information that linked the trial judge in criminal activity. She went to the state police because she was afraid. She was being followed. She provided the state police with a detailed description of the man who was following her and the vehicle that he drove. She expressed concern that she was being targeted because of what she knew. And what she knew was this. Among others, Roger Greathouse and the trial judge were on Roger Greathouse's property when a truckload of illegal drugs was being unloaded. The state police were not surprised to hear Roger Greathouse's name uttered in conjunction with illegal drug activity, for he was known to them as a drug dealer. Over 2 years later, James Harrison was charged with these murders. As the Indiana Supreme Court said about this case, the identity of the perpetrator was a seriously disputed issue. And so it's not surprising when defense counsel heard about Ms. Forsey's reports to the state police that their ears perked up. After all, Ms. Forsey had made these reports about being followed prior to the time that Mr. Harrison arrived in the state of Indiana.
When were these turned over to the defense? How did defense become aware of that?
According to testimony at the change of judge hearing by one of the police officers, I believe it was Officer Rhodes or Officer Gilbert, the defense learned about the reports to the state police sometime in the end of July. And it was shortly thereafter, at the end of July, where there was the in-chambers conference where the trial judge learned of Ms. Forsey's reports. That would have been July 1991.
So the defense counsel, some source indicated that such reports existed?
What defense counsel learned was that Ms. Forsey had made reports to the state police, or a report to the state police.
And then so requests were made for those reports by defense counsel?
Right. That the state police officers who took her, or with whom she spoke that day, testified that they did not take notes because it was being tape recorded. They further testified that not long after the homicides, they listened to the tape. Defense requested production of the tape at some point around this time, and it was then that they learned it was missing. It was at the end of July of 1991 when the parties had an in-chambers conference, and the trial judge at that point indicated he would not recuse himself. It was about three weeks after that he advanced Harrison's case on the trial docket, leaving counsel 78 days to prepare his defense, when before they had been led to believe they had 5 to 8 months to prepare. The day the change of judge motion was filed, however, all bets were off. The judge advocated a particular position, and that position was that Ms. Forsey's reports to the Indiana State Police were false. That position was adverse to James Harrison's. As Judge Barker found, Ms. Forsey's report to the Indiana State Police, and I quote, supplied circumstances pertinent to Harrison's defense that Stacy Forsey was targeted by the local drug community because she had knowledge of and provided information to the state police about drug activity, and that these actions made her silence necessary.
Are there other trial judges in this Mount Vernon area?
According to the 1991 legal directory, there was a inferior court at the time. I want to say.
So there was just
Judge Redwine and one other.
In the county?
Yes, sir, to my knowledge. Not only did he have a position that was adverse to Harrison's, but he advocated that position. He advocated it in at least three ways. He interviewed his witness, Roger Greathouse, in a substantive ex parte conversation. He presented evidence, including documents and witnesses, and cross-examined his opponent's evidence, and he provided legal counsel to his witness, one witness, that is. Because the day the change of judge motion was filed is when he called Mr. Greathouse and had the substantive ex parte conversation. Mr. Greathouse later testified that at the close of that conversation, having been made aware that he was being alleged to have had a truckload of illegal drugs unloaded on his property, inquired of the trial judge whether he needed to bring a lawyer with him to this hearing. And the judge told him that he need not do that.
Now, counsel says because that was recorded, that eviscerates the impact of that ex parte conversation. What's your response to that?
It does not. What was disclosed to the parties was that Judge Redwine had requested Roger Greathouse to come in and testify, and that during this time that request was made, that a court reporter was present. What is not disclosed is that there was a substantive ex parte conversation about the merits of Ms. Forsey's allegations to the state police, and also that during that conversation, the trial judge had made several statements, which are found in Judge Barker's opinion, expressing his personal discomfort, that he was taking this personally, that were of record as of that moment. Not only did the judge take a position that was adverse to Harrison's and then advocate his position, he then excluded all of the evidence that was adverse to his position. As Judge Barker found, the trial judge demonstrated his actual bias, and then I quote, by his, quote, personal participation in the development of the proceedings beginning at the change of judge hearing. She found he showed, and I quote, unmistakable bias, end quote, when he, quote, revealed a personal interest in protecting his name and the judiciary in Posey County, an interest he specifically admitted.
Well, standing alone, I guess that's not a position that isn't at least somewhat laudable, right? I mean,
Correct.
This is apart from whether one should have proceeded to continue to preside, but I mean to take an aggressive stance in rebutting what the judge apparently or obviously believes were baseless charges.
Standing alone, supporting the integrity of the bench is laudable. But when one looks at the entire record in this case, and particularly what the trial judge was going after in this case.
Is it your position that even if the charges were baseless, that the judge was so offended at the suggestion and therefore the subsequent change, Ms. Longsharp, that he then displayed a peak, if you will, through the remainder of the proceedings, which in effect morphed into a bias?
Yes, but I think that he cannot determine, he being the trial judge, cannot determine whether the allegations are baseless, and that is the extrajudicial source doctrine. He can't determine whether, for example, Roger Greathouse is a drug dealer or not.
No, but he certainly can speak to the issue of whether he was present at a vignette that
Correct.
Played out with,
Correct.
With drugs.
Much as some of the trial judges in the contempt disqualification cases decided by the United States Supreme Court can be understandably personally put off by what is being said to them. But at some point, I think as you mentioned during Mr. Martin's argument, at some point the scales tip and due process is violated, and these scales more than tipped.
Well, I don't want to shift you away from the thrust of that argument because I'm sure the panel is fully aware of it, but I do think the procedural default issue is mm-hmm. one that has to be addressed.
And I would very much like to address that, and I'll do that right now, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
The state says, obviously, that Judge Barker was incorrect in reaching the merits of the case. Below, the state claimed procedural default in two respects. It claimed that Mr. Harrison did not raise this claim as a federal due process claim, and it claimed that the state court's decision on direct appeal amounted to an adequate and independent ground. Those things are not being uttered today. It appears to be something quite different. But all those affirmative defenses are for naught if Harrison did exactly what he was supposed to do.
And then can you speak to that interplay between Baldwin, the Baldwin case, and our Ellsworth case? Because in
yes.
both of the cases, we use the language alert.
Yes.
And the Supreme Court also uses the language alerting the Supreme Court. So if you could speak to the interplay and whether you think Ellsworth was overruled by Baldwin or is consistent with it, give us your take.
I think Ellsworth is consistent with Baldwin. For our purposes, Baldwin stands for the unremarkable position that when you're raising a federal constitutional claim in state court, you got to tell the court it's a federal constitutional claim. Whether you cite the United States Constitution, whether you cite a particular federal case that invokes the right to which you refer, I think that the impetus in Baldwin was we as the United States Supreme Court cannot force a state Supreme Court or a lower state court to go beyond the record. We cannot force them to go beyond the record to figure out if there's a federal constitutional claim being raised.
Well, how did we have that here?
Pardon?
How did we have that here, Ms. Longsharp? If the mandamus route, assuming arguendo, was not the right route, and Indiana law, it seems to me, tilts against you on that, but now we turn to the brief on before the high court in Indiana, and it makes this passing reference, does it not, to basically raising it generally to preserve
for further appeal.
Further appeal, and that's better than not mentioning it all. But I suggest it really isn't a fulsome exposition of one's constitutional claim.
Well, I would say this: it is not it is not a law review article on the doctrine of judicial bias.
How about just an appellate brief on it?
Well, I would refer the court to page 16 of the brief of appellant on direct appeal. And page 16 on the brief of appellant on direct appeal says issue 2, argument, issue 2. At the very beginning of that is the following. The trial court denied defense motions as outlined below. For the sake of brevity, Harrison now states the trial court unconstitutionally denied these motions under the, and he cites the 5th, 6th, 8th, and 14th Amendments to the United States Constitution. That is on page 16 of the direct appeal brief of appellant. Then on page 17 is his reference to the motion for change of judge. There he says, defendant filed a motion for change of judge and a hearing was held. There was also a mandamus held, and the Indiana Supreme Court heard the issue and denied the motion prior to trial. The issue is now raised for purposes of preserving the same for further appeal. Harrison would contend he was denied a fair and impartial trial by jury by not having a change of venue from the judge. He has used federal constitutional terms. He has specifically cited to the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution and has re-raised a claim that he raised in mandamus proceedings.
But he has not relied on any of the events that occurred at trial prior to the denial of the petition for mandamus. He never invites the Supreme Court of Indiana's attention to any of the claims he now makes that the judge, in fact, manifested bias throughout the trial. Could the district court and can we now even look at those things?
Yes, you can.
It sounds to me like didn't he sandbag the state court?
No, sir. Even if that was his intent, which I would submit it was not, the Indiana Supreme Court indicated in its decision that it had independently reviewed the record for facts to support the claim of judicial bias.
On direct appeal or on collateral attack?
On direct appeal, Your Honor. And I'll refer the court to one moment. 644 Northeast 2nd at 1249, which is Harrison versus State on direct appeal. 1249 will be the pen
site. Said that really fast. 644.
I'm sorry.
Northeast 2nd.
644 Northeast 2nd, 1249 is
okay.
The pen site, where they say, here defendant states no facts in his brief before this court, nor can we find any in the record. We know that the Indiana Supreme Court reviewed the record for facts to support this claim simply because they said they did.
Ms. Longsharp, if this claim were to be found procedurally defaulted,
mm-hmm.
Could Harrison overcome the default by showing cause and prejudice from the default?
He could, Your Honor. He has also alleged manifest injustice. with regard, I believe, to this claim.
So if this case were to return to the district court, would there be an attempt made to show that counsel on direct appeal was constitutionally inadequate?
I will say, Your Honor, I do not believe that he exhausted that particular area of cause. My memory is that, in fact, is believe that's the reason that only miscarriage appeals, and now I'm thinking about that only miscarriage would appear in the habeas petition.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, you didn't address that here, obviously.
No, sir.
Well, you're defending a,
yes, sir.
A victory below, I understand.
So we know that Mr. Harrison raised a federal constitutional claim on direct appeal, and the Indiana Supreme Court reviewed the facts to determine, if that answers your question, Judge Ripple, that which Harrison claimed. Although I'd like to go back and see if maybe Chief Judge Flom, I could persuade you on this mandamus action. Mandate is generally, Mr. Martin is correct, it is disfavored in Indiana, but the rule provides specifically for two types of issues to be brought up on mandamus, and they're the understandable structural type of issues of this kind that the court is more likely to hear, and the rule indicates that. This is not like the situation where Mr. Harrison sought a mandamus and the court said, we're not going to hear your claim. This is a far different situation than that. For here, he filed an emergency petition for writ of mandamus. The court agreed to hear it, briefs were filed, oral argument was had, and they issued a decision denying, that's all it says, denial or notice of denial of the writ. There isn't any dispute. In fact,
well, this 84 case, Robinson versus Grant Superior,
yes,
contains language that the mandate will lie only if the remedy by appeal is wholly inadequate.
Well, the Indiana Supreme Court has granted change of judge issues in mandamus proceedings before. That's why it's there. It's not that we're not going to take change of judge issues. And obviously that would make some sense from a policy standpoint. If you've got a judge problem, then that's going to pollute the entire trial. It's best to do that at the beginning and move on with a new judge if necessary.
This is a slightly different, going down slightly different path, but since we're talking about policy issues, as you know, many of the allegations against Judge Redwine were double and triple hearsay. And how do we find that he was biased? Well, at the same time, guard against the possibility, which counsel suggested, of litigants making nasty rumors about a judge simply to get the judge off the case and make that claim of judicial bias.
Can I do that backwards?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. First of all, this claim of this policy consideration, it was not Mr. Harrison's lawyers or Mr. Harrison who made these allegations. It was Ms. Forsey going to the state police. That is the extrajudicial source here. It's not, a criminal defendant coming in and making stuff up. So that policy consideration that Mr. Martin raised is legitimate, but just simply inapplicable here. As to the hearsay allegations, I guess I would first say these weren't as far removed hearsay as Mr. Martin made it sound. There are two groups of people who provided information. The first group, which is referenced in the state's reply brief, I believe, are the two police officers, Officer Rhodes and Officer Gilbert. Those are the two individuals that spoke with Ms. Forsey the day she came to the state police post. Those are the ones who took no notes, that tape recorded the conversation, that allegedly later, at some point, their tape got lost. They are testifying from memory that Ms. Forsey told them that she really wasn't on Roger Greathouse's property, that she didn't see any of this, that somebody told her that. That's what the state police officers say. Then you look at the other reports that are discussed at the change of judge hearing, and particularly at page 597 of the transcript, Mr. John Forsey's report, statements to the police are discussed, where he indicates that Ms. Forsey told him directly. She, quote, she had seen Judge Redwine at Roger Greathouse's party, and there was cocaine there, and she had seen him, and she said that she knows it was him. She had seen him at court also, and she said a doubt, without a doubt, that was him. Another member of her family, Dina Woodruff, her report at 5, looks like 92 of the transcript. She went out to Roger Greathouse's place, and she said, continuing, and Judge Redwine were out there, and Roger had just got a shipment of drugs in a semi from Florida, and that they had them in on the pool table, every kind you can imagine, spread out. And whether it's true or not, I'm not saying, but she believed it with all her heart. Ms. Forsey's mother also testified, describing what Ms. Forsey told her. She said, at page 695 of the transcript, well, I didn't say cocaine. What Stacy saw, she was in the kitchen and she had Tia, and they left directly. Tia was Ms. Forsey's daughter. And they left directly. Was Roger in a shipment of drugs, and they had them all over the pool table. And Chuck told her they were going to have it because men had started to arrive. And the trial judge interrupts. Was Mr. Hanmore there too? At page 696, she says, she being Miss Forsey, the mother. Yes. Well, she couldn't get out there otherwise. She didn't know them. That was before she had Jordan. And he told her that they had to go because she was not supposed to be there, and the men were starting to arrive. And like I said, she didn't know anybody politically or anything, so the name she came up with had to be told to her because she just didn't know anybody. And then back to Mr. John Forsey, who says that after she left court and saw Judge Redwine on the paternity action, she then came back to him and said, now I'm sure the guy that was there was the trial judge. So these are not, you know, triple and quadruple hearsay. I mean, if she had said to a member of her family something about Mr. Harrison, she saw him at a particular place. It's the police officers and ultimately Judge Redwine who characterized this as quadruple hearsay, triple hearsay, when in fact that just simply isn't the case. If that answers your question.
Thank you.
On mandamus, federal constitutional question, facts to support, to the highest state court in the state of Indiana. On direct appeal, federal constitutional claim raised, asked for reconsideration, claims the right to, quote unquote, an impartial judge. The state Supreme Court indicated it reviewed the entire record and determined that Mr. Harrison was not entitled to relief. Twice to the highest state court, twice federal constitutional claims, twice facts reviewed. Judge Barker's decision that there was no default in this case is accurate. And then there's the final matter of assuming, for the sake of argument, that this was an adjudication on the merits. And for brevity's sake, let me just run quickly to the contrary to clause finding that Judge Barker made.
Can I just go back for a minute? We had just an affirmance order on the mandamus, but there were Indiana Supreme Court decisions on the merits in this case.
The decision would be the 644 Northeast 2nd. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the first page site. But it'll be cited in the papers. It's the direct appeal opinion. They did discuss that. The question is, what was that? Was that an adjudication of the federal constitutional claim? Judge Barker said, the reasoning of the state Supreme Court escapes easy understanding. And I understand why she said that. If it is a federal constitutional claim, if it is that, it still required Harrison to make an affirmative showing of prejudice. And in February of this last year, this same year, Franklin versus McCautry was decided by this court, which held that the Wisconsin Supreme Court requirement of prejudice, an affirmative showing of prejudice in a judicial bias case, was contrary to clearly established law, and that for the Franklin case we cited, we added in supplemental authority several months ago. Mr. Martin also suggested that really this requirement of prejudice that the state Supreme Court was discussing was something to do with fundamental error. The two cases we recently cited, Stidham versus State and Harrington versus State, show clearly that the Indiana Supreme Court was reviewing something on the merits, and this was no finding of default. I'm about out of time. Are there any further questions? Well, it's an honor to be here. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Longshot. Mr. Martin?
Your Honor, in response to Ms. Longsharp's arguments, the characterization of the Indiana Supreme Court's disposition of the petition for mandamus was exactly a summary denial. To the extent that Ms. Longsharp suggests that there was oral argument held, I don't dispute that if she or counsel for the petitioner can point to some record materials that suggest that there was argument. I did not find that in my own review of the record. Regardless, the Indiana Supreme Court frequently hears argument on, for instance, petitions to transfer, and does not necessarily grant transfer or find transfer appropriate after hearing argument. However, we know that to present something to the state's highest court, to preserve it for a habeas review, it has to be done in a procedurally proper manner. If a petitioner presents a claim to the state's highest court in a petition to transfer and it's submitted late or does not conform with the rules for a petition for transfer, it is not found to have been properly raised to preserve it for habeas review. With respect to the character of the hearsay allegations, there was at the time of Harrison's trial a rule regarding the admissibility of evidence of a third party's culpability for the offenses. And rumor or speculation would not suffice to make that evidence admissible. Rather, it had to in some way directly tie the person that is alleged to be culpable to the crime. And it's interesting that the standards for federal review of a motion for recusal similarly find that simple conclusions, opinions, or rumors are not sufficient to state a case of judge bias, and that the factual averments to support that have to be stated with particularity, and they have to be definite as to times, places, persons, and circumstances. And if you look at the accounts that were adduced at the change of judge hearing regarding Stacey Forsey's statements, they are anything but particular with regard to times, places, persons, and circumstances. And depending on which person was relating the statements that Stacey purportedly made, you got varying versions of what she said and when she said it. For instance, Ms. Forsey's mother, Gloria, had testified that when she related this story about the, and I'll call it a drug party for lack of a more succinct term, that at that time, Stacey had not yet had her child, Jordan, had not gone through the paternity actions, and would have had no way of knowing who Judge Redwine was, absent being told that a particular individual might have been Judge Redwine or some of the other prominent people that were mentioned in the statements by Chuck Hanmore. So there's absolutely no reliability, certainly not enough to have rendered any of this evidence admissible for the purposes of suggesting that a third party was culpable for the offense. And finally, with regard to the suggestion that Judge Redwine conducted the balance of the proceedings with something of a peak, I think, as you just described it, Judge.
No, it's not really a term of art. I just...
but I think it aptly conveys the point. But I think that a review of the record will show that there were legitimate reasons for everything that Judge Redwine did that weren't related to a bias against Mr. Harrison. And one that I wanted to point out was the moving up of the trial date. the record shows that as of April 29, 1991, the court had discussed with the parties the possibility of exchanging the trial dates for another capital case, which was for a defendant named Jeffrey Paul and Mr. Harrison, both of whom at that time were being represented by Mr. Harrison's trial counsel. And then on August 19th, the court told the parties that they would exchange the trial dates, and this was before the hearing on the change of judge motion.
Is that defense counsel, Mr. Swain? Is that who we're talking
about?
Yes,
Your Honor.
Well, are you suggesting that he was representing two different parties and he had had a schedule with the A case and the B case?
Yes,
and he was told originally what's the A and what's the B, and he prepares, and then the judge raises with him the switching of that? I'm a little concerned about, you know, the preparation that goes into capital cases is always under substantial pressure and indeed scrutiny eventually by high court. So I don't quite understand this discussion about changing the dates.
Well, at the April 29th, 1991 discussion, Your Honor, Judge Redwine had told the attorneys to be ready to try either of those cases on the date that was reserved for November 6th to the 26th.
And it was going to be left to the judge's discretion which one goes first. Is that what we're being told, Mr. Martin?
That's correct. And then later, Judge Redwine asked those attorneys to step down from their defense of Mr. Paul, and they were allowed at that point to focus exclusively on Mr. Harrison. And again, I'm not arguing to the court that Judge Redwine may have followed the best course in any one of these given instances, but I think that there are legitimate reasons for each of the things that he did.
And then with speaking of this Thomas Swain, at the time that he was appointed to represent Harrison, he was receiving other appointments, and you know, once this recusal motion, this mandamus was filed, he didn't receive any other appointments. And that's just another...
That's what the record reflects, Your Honor. But I would suggest that it's not enough to show bias, or that at least the Indiana Supreme Court was not unreasonable in concluding that that was the case. We would ask that this court reverse the district court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.